Welcome to the world of Culture Pop with Steve Mason and Sue Kalinske. Culture.
Comedy, movies, TV, tech, authors, trends.
Pop.
Pop. This is the Culture Pop Podcast.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Culture Pop Podcast. I'm Steve Mason along with Sue Kalinske. And Sue, take a shot. What number podcast do you think this is for us? Off the top of your head.
Oh, God. I think it's, is it 90?
88. You're a little over 88, but we will get to 90. I promise you. Today, we got a great one. Our guest is one of the finest actors working today. He has starred in Full Metal Jacket, Natural Born Killers, Jurassic Park, Amistad, and so many more. And in his latest film, he plays Hollywood legend Louis B. Mayer in David Fincher's Mank. Arliss Howard joins us.
Well, thanks for having me, guys.
So I'm a huge Fincher guy. I love all David Fincher movies. So I love this movie, obviously. I think it's just a masterpiece. How did you wind up playing the role of Louis B. Mayer?
I don't know, actually. I never got an answer from him. I was in Pittsburgh, and I got a call saying, David Fincher wants to talk to you. And as I've said, at this stage of my working life, I work more, I like writing and directing more. And so I don't work as an actor so much. And I thought he was just calling me up to vet one of his actors, because I've worked with, you know, some real characters over the years. So I thought he was just calling to see, hey, so-and-so is going to do this. Have you worked with him? Do you, you know, whatever. And so I said, yeah, I'll talk to him. Plus my son and I watch Benjamin Button every year at Thanksgiving. And so I get on the phone with him, and 45 minutes later, he says, after he lays out the story of it and that his dad had written it, he said, so would you be interested in playing Louis B. Mayer? And I said, why? I mean, I didn't see it at all. And he said, really? I said, no, I don't. And he said, well, I'm going to send you something to read. And I read it, and I wasn't, you know, four pages in when I went, oh, because whatever you want to say about David, the movies, whatever, it's very subjective, people's opinions and tastes and what have you. And these days, everybody's happy to drop them on you. Good writing is good writing. And this is, in my view, unimpeachably good writing. And it creates a world, and it's of another time and all that stuff. So I was in before I even got to my part. And then when I read Mayer and his long explanation of the movie business, I said, yeah, that'll be fun. So that's how that happened.
It's such a beautiful movie. I mean, it's shot. I mean, it really looks like it was in that time, you know. I mean, from everything to the way the transitions are, you know, just it like it was made back in the 30s or 40s. But, you know, it's crazy how people get, you know, so nitpicky. I was reading some criticism about how the framing that was used was different. Like, Fincher went, you know, to great lengths to make it be that, but the framing was not exactly the framing that, you know, it wasn't the square framing, I guess, that was used back then. And, you know, I was just thinking to myself, someone made some comment about the Queen's Gambit, the song Venus. And they said, oh, you know, yeah, I liked it, but they used the song Venus and it wasn't even written. And then somebody responded, oh, just sit back and enjoy the show, you know? So kind of a weak critique, do you think?
You know, people are going to have opinions. I'm not sure we're born with them, but we sure do learn them, you know, how to have one. And that's all fine. And everybody now with the way it is, everybody can weigh in, and they have, you know, websites, you know, donated and purposed for people to sling it back and forth. I think the thing that I find is I give people a lot of allowance nowadays, because a lot of people don't have anything else to do except watch movies and vent their frustration that's probably meant to go elsewhere. In this particular case, this is not you know, David said, I would like this to look like a movie that you found in a vault that was made around 1930s. And I think for my money, what he's saying by that is not literally, I expect it to look like that. But what he's saying is, I'm going to create a world that is evocative of that, because this is not like people say, well, you're playing a real guy. Well, I'm not. I'm playing David Fincher's Louis B. Mayer. There's no such thing as a real character in a movie. Even in a documentary, by the when you're cutting and you're assembling it, you're applying an editorial point of view that is not, quote, real life. So I don't have any problem with people nitpicking or whatever, because it doesn't have anything to do with me. Or ultimately, I think this film, I think David is, it's fairly assured that David will be looked back upon as a real boundary pusher.
No question. There's a line in the movie that grabbed me, and it's really sort of at the heart. You know, I used to own movie theaters. I when movie theaters were open, I go to the movies all the time. Louis B. Mayer says, this is a business where the buyer gets nothing for his money but a memory. What he bought still belongs to the man who sold it. That's the real magic of the movies, and don't let anybody tell you any different. That line just jumped out at me. What do you think?
I think Mark Zuckerberg could say the same thing. You know,
yeah.
When you think about what Facebook is and what it's become, I think what Mayer is saying there applies to many, many ways to business as is done today. When you think about a lot of tech business, there's an illusion that you have access to something, or that you're using the infrastructure of it to accelerate your business or whatever. But in the meantime, Facebook is just taking every single fact of piece of information the minute you click, and monetizing it and selling it. So you really they really own, in the same way that that Mayer is talking about, as a business model. What an amazing business that for that little period of time, you have essentially given up what amounts to your identity in market capitalism anyway. And I think that Mayer was a junk dealer who got into the movie business because of this romance he had about America, like a lot of immigrants do. And he essentially invented his persona and his life. And he was just, when he says it, it's sort of in rapture. Like, isn't this an amazing thing? It's not derisory or derogatory in any way. He really believes that this could only happen in America, and it is the greatest business that ever was. And I think I think he's foreshadowing a lot of the way that business is done right now, virtually.
Yep.
So, you know, the film obviously is based or inspired by true facts of, you know, of that time with Citizen Kane and Orson Welles. And it's in the film, it depicts that Welles didn't have anything to do with the script, really. I mean, creatively, he, you know, said to Mank, you know, you're not going to get screen credit. But he did have a lot to do with the film. I mean, from my reading about it, you know, he cut the film down from the massive, you know, original script, and he added a lot of things that weren't in the original script. When a film is inspired by historical facts, does the director, does he have a responsibility to be factual about certain things?
I think what goes missing in this kind of conversation that I've understood to be going on about the authorship of films is largely based in whether or not you think a director is the author of the film, which is essentially a collaborative endeavor. And what happens to a script, which is always written to be shot, it's not meant to be read. And I think Mankiewicz says, I gave him, you know, this thing, and he'll do with it what he's going to do with it. I mean, he says it in the movie. I gave him this document, this path, this way to go, and he'll he'll do with it what he's going to do with it. He didn't have a problem with Wells coming in and cutting scenes or any of that stuff. He knew that was going to happen. At issue is the notion of whether or not that it was credited, or that, you know, Pauline Kael's thing that supposedly Jack read and kind of inspired, you know, this writing, which was erroneous in any number of ways, because I've read it about the authorship of Kane, because what she was prosecuting was this anti-notion of the auteur. For whatever reason, that really got up her nose about, you know, these auteur filmmakers that were running around, you know, just savaging screenplays and doing whatever the hell they wanted to. And I don't think any responsible filmmaker would ever suggest that he could make a movie on his own. But I don't think any intelligent screenwriter either, when he wrote the screenplay, envisioned it exactly the way that it was going to be shot. And what Wells did with that, and Fincher is on the record as saying this as well, he's a genius. I mean, he's 25 years old, and he's coming up with shot angles and cutting and ins and outs of scenes that were used afterwards and were not used before. So Wells, the notion of his contribution to Kane is sort of silly in my view, because he started with a map and he took you on a trip. And, you know, I think Mankiewicz wanted credit because for the first time in his life, he thought he had really written something that was worth having credit for. It's a completely different world they were writing in back then, by the way, too.
You know, there are a couple of really long takes in the movie, and I love a good long take when I'm watching a movie. At Louis B. Mayer's birthday party is one of them. How difficult is it to shoot one of these long takes?
Well, there's a lot happening, you know, and when you see it, like I was in New Zealand when the film came out, and I was one of probably the only person who got to see it of the people involved that got to actually see it in a theater. And I'd seen it already, you know, on my computer. And the difference is extraordinary in terms of what's happening in the frame that you notice because of depth of field and perspective and just the sheer size of it, of the experience is much more immersive. But David's, and this is true of Kubrick, this is true of Spielberg, this is true of all really top-notch shooters, is they really believe that they're responsible for everything in every frame. So there's a lot going on, and to make all of it come together in a moment takes a while, and it takes many tries at it. You know, you can have a really good performance, but the camera slid sideways and we didn't hold the focus we wanted. And David doesn't miss any of that. So it takes some time. It's very exacting. But as Oldman pointed out to me one day when we were sitting around and somebody's going, God, how many takes are we going to do? And Oldman said, look, we're hired from 12 to 14 hours a day. We're going to be here working. It doesn't matter whether we do one take or 100, you know, we'll start the day and we'll shoot. And then at the end of the day, we'll go home. So when you understand that you're not in the hands of somebody who's indulging himself instead of somebody who's a big game hunter and he's looking for the thing, you know.
Yeah.
It really is fine. You know, it's fine.
Is the truth about Finch, all the stories about the many takes and all that stuff, is that all true to fact?
Oh, I would say probably he shoots more takes than your average shooter, you know, and I've worked with. But see, I'm one of the few people that's, you know, that I know of that's worked with Spielberg, Kubrick, and Fincher. And Steven doesn't shoot a lot of takes. That's just not the nature of what he's looking to do. But Kubrick shoots a lot of takes. And in fact, I was talking to Modine about, he called the other night, you know, to weigh in on Mank. It was very sweet. I hadn't talked to him in a while. And we were talking about this scene in Full Metal Jacket where he and I are mopping a floor, and we got up to 78 takes, and we had tea and then we had lunch. So it was a day's work on this one little, you know, 15 second scene. And I remember thinking, the reason we're doing this is Matthew would do something or I would do something, and Stanley would say, oh, let's do another like that. And then we kept digging, going. And at the end of it, there was this kind of robotic, slow, languid quality to the shot that you could only get if you were doing the same thing over and over and over and over and over again, which is exactly what these two guys were doing, which was mopping a latrine. And so, I don't know, maybe he could have printed the 28th take, or maybe it could have, but who knows? It's all just anecdotal anyway. You're in the hands of somebody who's, you either sign up or you just say no thank you, in my view. But I would say that the number of takes is not really the issue with David. It's you feel that somebody is really looking for something, and until he sees it, he won't really know what it is.
You know, it's interesting that you brought that up, because I rewatched Full Metal Jacket yesterday after not seeing it since it first came out. And I was thinking how grueling it was during those PT scenes, and knowing that about Kubrick, because I had read that he shot like dozens and dozens of takes. What was the prep like to get in shape for something like that?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've asked the question over the years by people, did you go to the boot camp? Because it became fashionable, you know, whenever there was a war movie, for somebody like Dale Dye to sign on and be an advisor and then get in the movie. And then he would do a boot camp and everybody would go out and be abused for a couple of weeks or whatever. And Stanley's thing about this is, I want you to be able to handle the weapon as if it were a baseball bat. I want you to be able to handle the weapon as if it were a pen that you know, were writing letters with. I want you to be really familiar. And that's all he really cared about. So a lot of the work we did was just assembling and disassembling weapons. And when I finished, I could take apart and put back together an M16 blindfolded. It's not a particularly useful talent, but it was only to be familiar with the weapon. The other stuff, since we were shooting basic, was to come in kind of green and do it as we went along. And of course, we had Lee Ermey, who was an actual DI at Paris Island. So Lee was just, you know, hilariously and formidably abusive. And it was much better to do that without any kind of preparation. As we got into it deeper and deeper, of course, we were doing work. But you do that as an actor in general, you know, just so that you get comfortable, so you can... I always use boxing movies as a metaphor for this, because the publicist will always come out with, by God, if De Niro had really wanted to, he could have been a contender, you know, back in the day, or Daniel Day-Lewis or Will Smith, they could have been, you know, and everybody knows that a moderately trained club fighter would annihilate a guy with one hook to the kidney, and you're never going to fight for a month. There's no way in hell that the essential financial element of a movie is going to be allowed to be hit by somebody whose job is to hit you so you'll stop fighting. And so it's more interesting, the illusion of that. You see Will Smith and Ali, and the illusion that he gives you of Ali is so breathtaking. And it has only a little bit to do with the fact that he moves and holds himself like a fighter. It's the spirit of it, and the way he, particularly when he's moving backwards, it's just an extraordinary performance, but it's an illusion. You know, this is all about an illusion. It's giving you the illusion. That's what I love about this, you know, about this kind of work. It's like trying to do magic tricks all the time.
You know, you worked with Spielberg, obviously David Fincher right now, Kubrick, Oliver Stone. Is there... aside from the number of takes and sort of the mechanics of it, is there some commonality between those guys, something that they all have that the rest of us don't?
Yeah, I don't know if it's the rest of us don't. I think it's like, you know, I had a friend, I'd start by saying this. I had a friend that I grew up with whose dad worked on the assembly line at the down Clay Como there in Missouri, putting cars together. And I used to love to watch him in his shop, in his basement. He had a die down there and he would make, you know, little gadgets and things for equipment. You know, I remember him working on a chainsaw carburetor one time that he was making, you know, by himself. Anybody who does something really well to me is worth watching. I don't care what it is. So the idea that these guys are different is only to the degree that anybody who does one specific thing, whether it's ride a horse, whether it's hit a baseball, you know, that they seem to be of a different species. What I would say about these guys is there's always a point where you see them looking off into the middle distance and everybody's waiting for them, you know, to make a decision, because that's what directing is constantly making decisions. And there'll be a moment where they just kind of sit back and sort of like dream. And that's what I remember about each one of those guys, is this moment of kind of, well, I'm here, it costs $400,000 a day, which works out to, you know, $80,000, $90,000 this particular sequence. I can feel the money breathing down my neck. I got an actor who doesn't know what he's doing. I've got a sick crew member. The location's bad. The light's going. And I'm going to pick that particular time just to sit back and kick it and wait for something to come to me. They all have that kind of where time just doesn't have anything to do with what they're doing in that moment, you know, a kind of dreamy quality. And I really love that. So that's what I would say, you know, kind of unites them, is that they're looking for something that is very personal.
So I actually had to do a little bit of catch up on your acting career. I'm everything you've done, I've loved. I got to see Big Bad Love a couple of nights ago.
No.
And it was just phenomenal and such an ambitious film. This was your directorial debut. And I want to know, you know, what drew you to make this your first feature?
You know, it's funny. I'm so happy you looked at it. My son's new wife looked at it the other night, and she was so lovely in what she said about it, because, you know, these are documents, these things you make that you look back on, and you go, what the hell was I thinking about? You know, like, because it's 20 years ago, that film. And I think over the years, people had said to me, you know, you ought to direct. And I thought they were complimenting me, but it was generally directors who were saying, you're a pain in the ass. And when you direct, you're going to find out exactly why you're a pain in the ass. And the reason you're a pain in the ass is because you're asking questions that are not actor questions. You're asking directorial questions. And A, it's none of your business right now. And B, you're asking them between action and cut when you're supposed to be doing your job. And I was always interested. I remember one of the most glorious days of my life was sitting down shooting a scene where Crazy Earl dies in Full Metal Jacket and I take over the squad. And he was putting the camera really low on the deck and I was down in this muck. And he's setting up the shot and he wanted explosions in the deep background going off on timers and guys crisscrossing and all this stuff. And he started talking to me about Japanese currency and why he was trading in it. And he started talking to me about gun placements at Normandy and why the political left has never been able to establish a successful rhetoric. And this all happened within an hour of him asking me questions and us talking about things. And I thought, well, why am I a pain in the ass? I mean, you know, I just thought this is what a director should be. He should be curious. So when I got sent this collection of stories, Big Bad Love, by this writer, Larry Brown, I experienced them as a film in a totality, the structure beginning to end with all the digression and all the little tinkering and adjustments I made to the arc of the narrative. And it just came to me as a movie. And so I, you know, knew a guy who felt like giving me some money and off we went, you know.
You know, the soundtrack was incredible. And oh, I can lovely. Tell. Oh, too. God, it was so
I
great.
I met all those and, guys. Yeah, Tom Waits wrote me a couple songs. It was pretty cool, the whole experience.
But I want to say that I can tell how important the music was to you, because it's the first time I've ever seen the credits come up and start with names of musicians instead of the actors. And yeah, that really touched me. I thought that was so cool, Arliss.
That's a lovely observation, Sue. I will tell you, that those guys had as much to do with the shape of that film. You know, R.L. Burnside is sort of a legendary. He's left us, but at that time, I really wanted to use his music, and I ran into him outside of a doctor's office. I had to go get a physical for the film, and he was sitting out there in his van smoking a cigarette. And I go, "Oh my God!" I said, "I want you to do a scene in this." In this movie, and he just blinking at me, and he said, "Well, if God wants that to happen, son, I believe it will." And so, R.L.'s famous for having said, you know, at one time he was in Parchment for murder. He shot a guy, and the guy, you know, passed, and so they put him in Parchment prison down Mississippi, and the planter he was working for really wanted him out. He was connected to the governor, and they pardoned him out after a few years. And somebody asked R.L. why he killed that guy, and he said, "Oh, I didn't kill him. I just shot him. Him dying was up to God." So these guys are like, you know, serious dudes and hilarious dudes, and they really did a number on me when I was down there, just immersing myself in that culture. I felt there was nothing else to do but let everybody know how I felt about them. That's usually the way you do it with credits.
So I want to go back to Mank for a minute. I love old Hollywood, and I've read a lot about old Hollywood and the beginnings of the industry. Do you think Louis B. Mayer would like your portrayal of him?
Gosh, I don't know. I imagine he had a different view of himself than the movie posits. You know, it's like David said that, you know, Mayer is the nominal villain. It's not just that he's the suit or that he owns the studio. It's the political part of it that the movie gets into, which I had no idea about. You know, the beginning of the weaponization of media, really, in terms of that kind of media, where you're using newsreel footage, posing as newsreel footage when it's actually not, in the services of defeating Upton Sinclair. And so he stands in for, I think, a sort of mindset and a political agitprop, which is, you know, this kind of rapacious cultural approbation by commercial interests. And I don't think Mayer would have ever seen himself as that. I think Mayer, if you look at his testimony at the House Un-American Activities Commission, the McCarthy hearings, when he talks about how he feels about America,
yep.
He saw himself as a defender of America. He saw himself as, you know, having those values, and he was very patriotic, and he changed his birthday to July 4th because that was the birthday of the United States of America. That stuff like that. So probably he would not like it just because he's positioned in the film as an antagonistic energy.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you mentioned you got to see Mank in a theater, and I miss movie theaters so much. And, you know, yeah. Netflix is fantastic, and I know they put a lot of money into movies and all that stuff, and this is an ambitious film. But movies are meant to be seen in theaters. Do you think the theater business is going to bounce back from this pandemic, and what do you think it's going to look like?
You know, I asked a guy not too long ago at a studio who's sort of came up through the independent movement when they was running this subsidiary of one of the big studios, what he thought about the future of movies. And his feeling was kind of interesting. He said, "We did this to ourselves. in terms of the kind of movies we made that sort of obliterated a certain audience, where, you know, you get people that are in their 40s and 50s, they're sort of not served by the movie industry because
right, they don't want to go see like Avengers Endgame. It's sort of this middle area, sort of that mid-range price movie, that star-driven, yes, character-driven story. Those have sort of been lost and wind up streaming now.
Yeah, if you made Parallax View, for example, or if you made you could even make the case if you made To Kill a Mockingbird, you make it for television now. And you'd make it as a part series. You just don't have that anymore. But he said, what was interesting, the guy said he thought it would end up like opera. Like you would go to the opera once every, however, you know, times you went to the opera, once a month, once whatever, and it would be a night out. You'd have dinner there and you would, you know, make a night of it. And it would be an event instead of just something that you felt, you know, and you just walk down the street and you go, let's go to the movies. He said the theaters will be geared toward that. There will be less of them. There probably won't be nearly as many. You know, when you think about it, just in a relatively short period of time, I've seen pictures in Cold Spring, New York. There were 6 huge vaudeville houses in the 20s and 30s up there that had been repurposed as movie theaters. And people would come from all over around those urban areas. And you see these pictures of cars lining the street and the marquees all lit up and people on the street, and they're going out to eat and they're going to the movies, and it's a very big deal. And, you know, when I was a kid in Missouri, we'd drive down to Kansas City to see the movies, and it was a huge deal to see how the West was won in Cinerama, man. I think what's interesting is a lot of guys don't have nostalgia for that. They think they're suspect of nostalgia, and they're more interested in what it's going to look like when people are watching this stuff on their phones and stopping and starting it and talking through it and what kind of movies we're liable to make given that particular technology and the prevalence of it. That's an interesting thing to think about. I can only say for myself, just because it's imprinted on me, there's something about walking into a big dark space with a bunch of other people and the lights going down and the credits popping up and you know, oh, here we go, you know.
Right. Yeah, it's an event, you know. Yeah,
my first car date with a woman was with a girl, really. I was a boy in Kansas City. We drove down to Glenwood Theater to see The Godfather. I went down there 2 weeks ahead of time to buy tickets.
Yeah.
Wow. That's great. Was that your first? Oh, that was your first date, not your first movie.
But no, my first car date. Yeah, I thought, you know, well, I got to do something. I didn't, you know, it's funny about dating when you're that young. You think, I can't wait. I'm going to ask her out and ask her out. And then you're suddenly presented with the terror of, what are we going to do? And, you know, I was a kid raised by a preacher. I didn't know what to do. I can't take her to church. She probably wouldn't like that. It must be the movies. And it was a great choice.
Yeah, that is a great, great first date.
Because you don't have to worry about conversation too much.
No, you're absolutely right. And then all you talk about afterwards is the movie.
Right.
Yeah, it gives you something to talk about. Exactly. Yeah. So the movie is Mank. I could not recommend a film more highly. I think it is a modern masterpiece, and it is streaming now on Netflix, and it's great. Don't miss it. Don't miss it. And Arliss, thank you so much for doing this. We really appreciate it, man.
Oh, no, man. Thanks for having me. It's a lot of fun to talk about it, and I agree with you. I think it's a fantastic movie. I hope people go see it.
And there is Arliss Howard from the movie Mank. I love that film. I love that movie.
I did too. It's just so beautiful to look at. Also.
It is. It's beautiful to look at. You nailed it. Exactly right. And the cast is great. And, you know, I wouldn't say this with Arliss on the line, but I'm relatively certain he's going to be nominated for an Oscar.
Yeah, I think so too.
He's certainly in that conversation. I mean, that's the best supporting performance I've seen so far this year. By the way, movies are tough now. Because exactly what he was talking about, you know, you go to a theater and, you know, you're going to see the theater in this, see the movie in this big dark space in a communal sort of environment, and you can't hit the pause button. And the pause button, when I'm watching a movie at home, I pull the curtains down, room is dark, big screen TV, all quiet, and under no circumstances will I leave my seat. I want to treat it like it's a real movie. Instead of hitting the pause button. Do you hit the pause button?
Yeah, I do sometimes. But it's funny that you say that because I remember when theaters became smaller.
Yep.
I used to have a joke in my act that the coolest thing is that you can tell the projectionist that you have to go to the bathroom and to please pause it. You know?
Right.
You know? Yeah, I mean, I understand, you know, that feeling of, you know, you're doing something that you can't do at home, and I get that. But I like being home a lot of times and watching movies, to be honest with you, because I don't like dealing with people. I don't like dealing with people.
This must be the time of your life then.
Well, yeah, people talking, people, you know, making noise when they're trying to, you know, eat popcorn or candy or, you know, I've had many instances where I almost got into like huge fights with people because I asked somebody to please be quiet. And, you know, in this day and age, you know, you got to be really careful, you know, who you tell to do something because, you know, you can get hurt. But I totally get the whole experience of being in a theater. And actually when he was saying when he was a kid and he used to go to this specific theater to see like first run big movies, when I was growing up, my sister and I, my brothers went to summer camp before we did. So it was just the two of us and my parents spoiled us like crazy. Hmm. So every week, they took us to a theater in Long Island. It was in Syosset. It was the Syosset Movie Theater. And it was the only big screen movie theater that I knew was in Long Island. And, you know, the same thing, How the West Was Won, The Sound of Music. We went to all these amazing movies and it was like an event. So I totally do get that.
So I was a weird kid, right? So I loved movies, and I used to go to this place called the Glen Burn Cinemas, and I knew the owner and the guy that worked there. And by the way, years later, I realized, oh, they were boyfriends. they were together. It dawned on me later. But I used to go see art films. So I was the only 11-year-old was raving about Geraldine Page and The Trip to Bountiful. And Cinema Paradiso. Have you ever seen Cinema Paradiso?
Yes.
God, for somebody that loves movies, that is absolutely the movie. But a fun conversation with Arliss Howard. I hope he does get that Oscar nomination. He absolutely deserves it. Sue, I wanted to point this out. Mm-hmm. 1 in 5 people in Los Angeles right now is struggling to put food on the table. Mm-hmm. And this holiday season, I'm teaming up with Jacob Imrani to help people in need. So Jacob has partnered with the LA Food Bank, and their motto is Fighting Hunger, Giving Hope. That's Jacob, always there to give people hope during tough times. So you can go to calljacob.com and click on the donate button. Jacob will match a portion of all donations made. Again, go to calljacob.com today, and thanks for your support.
Wow, if I didn't love him already, I mean, that is amazing.
That's He's a great. Good dude. He's a really good dude, Jacob mm-hmm. is, yeah. All right, there you have it. There is your Culture Pop podcast. Sue, thanks a lot. Great talking to you. Great catching up.
Yep, you too, Steve.
And we'll see you next. Oh, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. We really appreciate when you do that, and we'll see you next time on the Culture Pop podcast.
Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review. We'll see you next week for an all-new episode of Culture Pop.